So, good morning all.
Good morning. Good morning.
We'll start today with two talks, one by me, one by Padmavajra. Our aim is really to simply hold up the theme before you so that it gains our collective attention and comes to life within us, each of us, and amongst us, and becomes part of our interaction with each other. We're not aiming to do anything exhaustive or definitive. Furthermore, Padmavajra and I haven't been talking to each other about it in any great depth. We've got our own individual approaches to the theme, and we haven't coordinated between us what we're going to say and how they're going to interact with each other. Last time we did, we had broad themes and we were talking from different sides to the same theme each day. This time we haven't. And of course this is for aesthetic reasons. I'm pretty sure that because we're paying attention to the same topic and we come from the same broad perspective, there will be an interaction between our two presentations. And perhaps in the interaction between those two presentations, more will be revealed than in the actual presentations themselves, if you see what I mean. So I'm beginning, speaking for half an hour, and then Padmavajra will speak for probably about half an hour. Why are we dealing with this particular theme? Why are we dealing with eros and beauty? Obviously, we're dealing with it from our own personal interests. These themes have great importance to us as individuals, but they all also have importance to us as a community. I've just come from, with Padmavajra, the Public Preceptors College meeting, which ended 3 days ago. And during that meeting, Mokshananda went to see Bhante and persuaded Bhante to speak to a camera. I think he was a bit reluctant. In fact, Bhante told me later that he was reluctant and that Mokshananda had to overcome his reluctance. So Mokshananda asked him if there's any message that he wanted to give to the public preceptors. And Bhante, in his very, very careful, considered way, said there was something he wanted to bring to our attention. What he wanted us to do was make sure that the six distinctive emphases of the Triratna community were understood, widely talked about, well known within the community. He said he had some sense that they'd rather slipped out of usage, and he would like us to emphasize them much more. You all know what they are, of course. They haven't slipped out of your individual consciousnesses. So I'm not going to go through them. But one of those, as you know, is the emphasis on art. It's interesting because these are distinctive emphases, aren't they? They're ways in which the Triratna community is distinctive from other Buddhist communities. We share so much with them. There's so much overlap with them. We share a vast body of teaching coming from the Buddha and later generations. But what is distinctive about the Triratna is these six features. And one of those features is the emphasis on art. So I took the trouble to listen to what Bhante had to say about the importance of art and his emphasis on art. And I'm going to give you a brief account of what he had to say. This was when his first talk after his illness in the early 2000s. He gave a talk in Manchester in which he recounted those six distinctive emphases again. And he put them very beautifully and very succinctly. It would be worth just listening to what he had to say on that occasion because it was so finely put. I think because Bhante's got less energy and he can't read, he's becoming more succinct and more pithy. So he's not going to waste time, he's just going to say what he's got to say. So what he said was that he thought, first of all, that the practice and appreciation of art and of beauty had an important place in spiritual life and in the life of people within the Triratna community. That the practice and appreciation of art and beauty have an important place in the spiritual life. And he thought that we should give great emphasis to this and should cultivate the appreciation and practice of art. He said we should do this because art has the capacity to develop our sensitivity. Through engagement with art, we become more sensitive to the world around us, more sensitive to our own inner life, more sensitive to other people. It gives us a means of refining our emotional life, so that our emotions are less crude, less animal, you might say, more subtle. And it opens the way to the experience of meditative states. As a result of engaging with the arts, we're able more easily to develop meditative states, higher meditative states. He went on to suggest, in that very subtle way that Bhante has, and I cannot possibly reproduce, that engagement with art even opens up insight. And he quoted, or didn't quote, but he referred to Wordsworth's lines written above Tintern Abbey. I was thinking if I'd caught this thought earlier, I might have asked Abhaya to read it to you, to read the particular section to you, which is presumably the one where he says something far more deeply interfused. I'm not sufficiently good at reading myself to abuse your ears, but maybe later Abhaya could read that to us, maybe before the meditation or something like that. So Bhante says that in those lines, Wordsworth strikes upon something very, very deep in life, even something that approaches or even parallels or coincides with the insights of the Dhamma. Insight with a capital I. Which is quite significant, isn't it? That the appreciation of the arts, whether appreciation in the receptive sense or appreciation in the active sense of making art, can lead us even into insight itself. And again, it's important, isn't it? Because it stresses that insight is not Buddhist, if you see what I mean. It's part of life. That what Buddhism does is give us a very direct and powerful and explicit way of approaching that. It's something in life, and it would be surprising if people didn't find their way to it who were not necessarily Buddhist. So Bhante says that through these lines, you have the distinct impression, he had the distinct impression that Wordsworth was approaching an experience very close to what we had come to through Buddhism. So he said that from the arts we can derive something that adds to and supports our spiritual lives. And he regards it as very important indeed that this is an active part of our collective life. We, Padmavajra and I, have felt it necessary to emphasise this, even though we know many people do value it very highly. No doubt there's a somewhat self-selecting group here. People have come because they value it so highly. But we consider that it's necessary to really emphasise this as something of a counterbalance to other interests and directions, which are not wrong, but they need to be amplified and placed in a wider context, the more conceptual and technical, as I called it last night. They need to be placed in this much more direct, natural responsiveness. So why is art significant, or rather, how does it have its significance? How does beauty have its significance? Why does it link with our Dhamma life and Dhamma practice? That's what I'm going to try to explore in these next few days. I'm going to try to give us some way of examining in vivo, in our actual experience as the days go by, how beauty, the experience of beauty, the experience of art, or of nature, can support our Dharma lives. How does it work? Not just support it, but be part of, be an expression of and a means of our Dharma life. How does it work? So what I'm going to do is pay attention to what I want to call the aesthetic moment, the moment of aesthetic experience that I'm convinced everybody here experiences, knows about. Probably it's why you've come interested in this particular theme. You've come because you value and know that experience. But I want to take the aesthetic moment and examine it more closely. I want to examine it so that it becomes a concern, well, an interest, an extra interest for us all collectively, so that during these days we pay more attention to that experience as the day goes on, as the night goes on sometimes, noticing these aesthetic moments and savouring them, holding them and staying with them, so deepening them by valuing them and appreciating them, holding them. I don't necessarily mean anything particularly exalted, but just those aesthetic moments that come and go throughout our day, savouring them, holding them on our tongues, so to speak, giving them a little bit of extra attention so that we remain with them. And at the same time, applying a little bit of reflective analysis to them, standing a little bit aside from them and looking at what's going on, looking at what's involved in those aesthetic moments, so that we can tease out the various ingredients in those moments. And by teasing them out, by understanding them more fully, we'll be able to explore them more deeply. This is, of course, the importance of a conceptualization in the Dhamma, that concepts allow us to reflect upon our experience so that we deepen it. We stand apart from our experience through conception, through conceptualization. We abstract from our experience through conceptualization so that we can reflect on it and enter into it more fully and deeply. In the Dhamma, we're not concerned with producing a very highly refined and polished conceptual parallel to reality. We're concerned with using thought to go beyond thought, as the Song of Meditation has it. We use concepts to end concepts and to enter directly and deeply into the nature of our experience. So I'd like us all to give special attention to these aesthetic moments, as I call them, at whatever level. They may not be ravishing and ecstatic. They may not carry you away so that you're unable to do anything else and you just have to stay with them. They may be just a glance or a glimpse. But whatever it is, notice it, stay with it, and savour it, and then at some point give some reflection to it. Some of you are highly gifted at this, I know. There are those who are very deeply interested in the arts present here. You know what I'm talking about, and just do it a little bit more and maybe contribute your experience to the general discussion. And those of us for whom this is perhaps less of a live area, we can give a little bit of extra attention. But just to illustrate what I mean, I want to mention a few of experiences that have come to me in the recent past. Not because I think they're very special, but because I think they illustrate what I mean. And I hope you will get some idea of what I'm talking about from. So just before I came here, I was looking out the window of my room up in the library block, down onto the pond, and it's astonishingly still at the moment. The surface of the pond is glassy, and it reflecting the trees beyond it, a beautiful array of trees, all different, willows and oaks and firs, all just ringing the pond, and reflected on the surface of the water. And of course the reflections don't simply mirror what's up there in the sky, so to speak, they cross them over. And there's a very light breeze just blowing across the surface of the water, which doesn't seem to break the stillness of the surface. It's still sort of glassy, but it's just slightly moving, which makes the reflections shift and change in relation to each other. And the play of light and shade on the surface of the water, deeply fascinating. Just for a few seconds, it caught my attention, a bit like out of the corner of the eye, and called me, pulled me, so that I wanted to look more, look further. At that point, 5 ducks jumped into the pond. And first of all, I was irritated with them for breaking my aesthetic moment. But then, once they got into the middle of the pond, they started preening themselves. And while they were preening themselves, they were sending concentric circles of ripples, which intersected with each other in a most perfect choreography that could never be created consciously. And added a new and even more delightful dimension to the experience. So many little incidents in my time here over this last week, because it's a very strange and beautiful time of year, isn't it, as we fade from autumn into winter, and you've still got the last remnants of the glory of autumn, the autumn colours are still there, but that stark beauty of the raw trees, so to speak, revealed by the leaves as they fall off is really gripping. Looking out across the meadow there, especially at the oaks, which are so expressive. They're dancing in their own frozen, slow way. Entrancing, as if there's a personality expressed through the tree in its own stance, its own posture or mudra even. Walking down a lane out of here, down the lane and to the right, there's a long straight lane which is lined with mainly oaks, but beech and other glorious English trees in their final stages of autumn, with leaves beginning to fall. The yellows and oranges and the subtle shades of brown, just entrancing. I remember I was walking down there with a friend who was deep in a very earnest conversation, and I completely lost what he was talking about. It was so entrancing. So many, many little experiences like that go on through the moment. And even strange little things like the archways over the corridor down there, outside corridor. The two archways, two buttresses that are arched, and as you approach them, there's something particularly pleasing about those arches. I suppose it reminds me a little of Vermeer or something like that, a certain framing and stillness and a sense of something beyond that's not quite expressed. So this is what I mean by aesthetic moments in that sense. Of course, they can come from art too, and from all the media of art. I went recently with Vidyaruchi to Hereford Cathedral, which is a rather glorious, if somewhat battered, Norman foundation, with wonderful Romanesque arches and windows in the main nave. And and it's a strange experience, these English cathedrals, aren't they? Because there's something rather forlorn at the same time as glorious about them. You feel yourself in the midst of such antiquity, this cathedral was founded 1,000 years ago, and its origins go back much further. I think the Anglo-Saxon foundation was in the 7th century. So beneath this 11th century cathedral is a 7th century cathedral somewhere. But it's also faded and battered. You know, the Protestants broke out the stained glass and whitewashed over the paintings. And there's a sense of forlornness and decay. And the wonderful Church of England, I think it's such a magnificent thing, the Church of England. Such a decent, honest, and utterly forlorn attempt to keep something that died long ago in life. It's a bit like sort of guarding with your hands a candle that has already gone out. But there's something brave and decent about that attempt. So, if slightly absurd. But as we're walking around enjoying the whole thing, sort of trying to work out what everything was and where it was, there was a lot of bustle going on around us because they were preparing for the installation, the enthronement of a new bishop, which was going to happen the next day. And so a verger very nicely came and apologised to us for the chaos of the cathedral, which all added to this experience of a particular moment in time. But they were clearly both setting things up in terms of moving chairs around and making flower arrangements and setting up the video. And the organist was practicing. And so every now and again, you'd get the most wonderful section of organ music. It would last maybe sometimes 2 minutes. Then he'd decide, OK, I've got that one, and move on to the next. So he'd never get a complete piece. But every now and again is sometimes really glorious, ravishing pieces of music, wonderful harmonies and tunes, and the full glory of a cathedral organ just filling that large space. And we just came to the crossing between the transept and the nave and choir. We're just standing there, just looking at the choir stalls, which are 14th century. And of course, he started in on a Bach fugue. And I'm a sucker for a Bach fugue. And I was completely lost. Just unable to move, unable to go anywhere. Just completely lost in this huge sound. Because an organ, you can't get it on a gramophone record. No, you don't even use those anymore, whatever they are. CD. You can't get it on a music machine. When you're in the presence of a live organ, every bone in your body shakes, your skull rattles, and the sound is not outside you, it's right inside you. And because it's Bach, and he was playing, it was a fugue that he was playing, I didn't recognize, but I couldn't name it, the BMW number. Anyway, you know what Bach does. He takes the fugue to the point at which you think you're going to explode with agony, because he's drawing out the tension between the different parts to the point of unbearableness. And unfortunately, what happens was the organist clearly decided he hadn't done that quite right. So he'd get to the point of utter tension, and then he'd stop and go over it again. We were almost in paroxysms. But nonetheless, it was an extraordinary moment. I found it interesting, because I'm a little bit deaf, I've been found myself less listening to music. I don't particularly enjoy listening to music on a, what do you call it? Hi-fi. A music machine. Oh, that's a good way of putting it. A music machine. I just don't enjoy it for some reason. But I enjoy music in a setting. I enjoy it if I go to a concert hall, or if I'm with somebody, like I'm coming down from northern Hungary to Budapest with one of our gypsy mitras, who was playing gypsy music on the music machine in his car. And, you know, he's so loving it and explaining what was going on. And while he was explaining it, it sort of came to life. And I found myself understanding much more fully and deeply what this music was doing and just how sophisticated and complex and musically satisfying it was. So I find it much that music comes to life for me in a situation. It doesn't seem to come to life so easily if I'm just listening to it. I think it's partly because my ears are not so good anymore. I seem to need the visual medium as well. But yeah, that is the sort of episode that I mean. That suddenly you're taken into an aesthetic moment that you'd not been expecting, you'd not been looking for, you'd not been preparing for, you'd not been working towards. It's just given to you. And you're ripped out of your ordinary state into this aesthetic moment. I could go on. Oh, but probably the main medium for me, apart from the written word, for aesthetic experience is film. I've been watching quite a lot of film recently. And it's one of the wonderful things about our age. We can see so much wrong with it, but there are so many really good films. And I watched with Srimala recently a wonderful bit film by an Italian director, whose name, as always, escapes me, which won the Oscar in for foreign films in 2013, I think. It's called La Grande Bellezza, The Great Beauty. I've recommended this all over the place, but and lots of people have said, why did you recommend that? Which I find a bit alarming in one way or another. The two possible interpretations, aren't there? Either I'm stupid or they are. But anyway, the film focuses on a 65-year-old. That's interesting, isn't it? Maybe you've got to be more than 65 to appreciate the film. But it focuses on a 65-year-old playboy who's a journalist who's been a kind of leader of high society, the Bunga Bunga generation of Berlusconi. Very rich and very playful and hedonistic, extreme hedonism of an Italian kind, which means perfect, absolutely perfect style. And the film is like that. The style is impeccable. But it's exploring the relationship between superficial beauty and deep beauty, la grande bellezza, the great beauty, which the leading character at one point says he's always been in search of and never found. And throughout the film, because of the extraordinary skill and sophistication of the filmmaking, you get glimpses of something that you couldn't name. At the end of the film, you can't exactly say what you saw, what it was that was so engaging about it. I mean, it's great seeing half-clad naked women dancing, and men, I'm sure. But it's not that. It's about something glimpsed, well, something far more deeply interfused that is sort of revealed but not stated. It's implied but not made explicit, which is much more deeply satisfying because it's not something that can be spoken or said. It's something glimpsed out of the corner of your eye, something caught a moment after it's gone. It's that sort of thing, a shadow flickering, rather than something right in the centre of the camera. There are so many wonderful films available to us, which is a remarkable feature of our times. There's also a huge amount of rubbish, some of which is very enjoyable. But we're so fortunate that there are really great films being made in our time. And for many of this is one of our strongest aesthetic experiences, probably. I think perhaps we take it too lightly. Need to dwell on these experiences and savour them. I still find myself in the mood of La Grande Bellezza. At times it just suddenly comes upon me, something that was communicated through that film that I can't quite grasp, and that is all the more valuable because I can't quite grasp it. it's not something conceptualizable in the end, or if you do conceptualize it, you begin to lose it. So many experiences like this that come and go throughout our lives and that are with us 1,000 times a day, but sometimes so glancingly that we hardly notice them. Just a certain arrangement of two books on a table, something about the way they lie on a square table, their relationship to each other just sort of pleases in a flash, and then it's gone. Something about the posture with which somebody's standing is really entrancing. Or somebody's face, and particularly this happens, of course, when you're in deep communication. I experienced this the other day, quite recently, yesterday, talking to somebody who, frankly, is not any great beauty, in all honesty. But in talking with him, and as our communication became deeper and deeper, there was something about his whole occupation of space that was deeply satisfying and absorbing and pleasing. So that this aesthetic moment, I think you've probably got some idea of what I'm talking about from my very inadequate and uneloquent expression of it, that you need really a poet to express. But I hope from that you've got something of what I'm asking us to focus upon, to catch these moments in your own day here, during these days, and to hold them, to savour them, and to begin to reflect upon them. Don't do the two things at the same time, if I can tell you what to do. I gather people don't like that. If I can respectfully and humbly suggest, hold the experience and savour it, and then after some time, when it's sort of gone from your tongue, reflect upon it and look at it. What happened? What was going on? What did that signify? I'm going to explore that myself in these next few days. I'm going to look at this from a more conceptual point of view. But for now, what I want to suggest is that there are three aspects of the experience to reflect upon and examine, and invite you to savour, post-savouring, reflectively analyse the experience from these points of view. Every experiencing moment, according to basic Buddhism, has three fundamental components. There's the knower, and the known, and the knowing, or the subject of experience, the object of experience, and the consciousness, the experiencing itself. I prefer to use this language of knowing because I think it gets closer to what we're talking about and gives us a spread of different ways of knowing. Consciousness is knowing. Consciousness knows its object. That's a Sangha's Abhidhamma definition. So in every moment of consciousness, we are knowing, or we, the knower, are knowing the object of consciousness. So in every experiencing moment, well, of whatever kind, these three components are present in a relationship to each other. Of course, we'll have to look much more closely at what we mean by each of those and what their reality is, because Dhamma does not leave these notions unexamined. But in every aesthetic moment, those three elements will be present. There will be a knower, oneself. There will be a known, whatever the object of attention is, the aesthetic object is. And there will be a knowing, a state of mind, a state of consciousness, an experiencing. And all those three are part of the moment of aesthetic experience. And all three require our attention. So what one can ask is, what is it about the object that lends it to an aesthetic moment? Why has this object, what's happened to this object that makes it an aesthetic object? Very often you're paying attention to something, you know, a tree, and to begin with, it's not an aesthetic object. It's simply an object of perception or an object of reflection or conception. And then it becomes an aesthetic object. So what's happened to that object? Some change has taken place in it. You could even say it's a different object. What's happened to it? And what about you, from your end? What's happened to you that shifted you from the subject of perceiving or the subject of conceptualizing to the subject of aesthetic appreciation? There's been a change in you. You might even say, from a strict point of view, that there's a different you. And then what's happened to the knowing? What's happened to the consciousness? What's happened to the experiencing itself? What's different about that experiencing? You know, when you're in the state of, as it were, everyday consciousness, where you're just looking at something and perceiving it, the experience, the consciousness is of one kind, and when you enter into an aesthetic experience, the consciousness is of another kind. So what is going on? That's what I'm going to explore, and I'm hoping that I'm going to explore out loud, and I'm hoping that in my exploration out loud, I'll be paralleling or echoing, maybe lagging behind even, your explorations of what's going on in the aesthetic moment. And that's what I like in my sessions in the morning to be exploring, what this aesthetic moment is, what is the knower in that aesthetic moment, what is the knowing in that aesthetic moment, and what is the object, and how are these different from another moment. So I'll leave it there, and hopefully you'll find some food for reflection. I think this particular event works mainly by us all engaging with the theme. And what I'm offering is at least a way in which you might choose to engage with the theme by reflecting on those aesthetic moments, catching them and savouring them, and then reflecting on them analytically, but not destructively analytically. Thank you.